My name is Eric Owens, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life here at Boston College. And I'm delighted to welcome you and our distinguished guests here this afternoon, who I'll introduce very shortly. Our panel, clearly a major highlight of our academic year at the Boisy Center and at Boston College, but we do have many other events that I'd like to mention a small selection of. On March 18th, Timothy Shaw from the Council on Foreign Relations will be speaking in Devlin 101 on evangelicals and democracy around the world, and Professor Alan Wolfe will be giving a response afterwards. And just weeks after the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, theology professor Stephen Pope will be speaking, will be giving a lecture on human evolution and Christian ethics. That's on March 31st in Cushing 001, 5 p.m. And then our final major panel of the semester puts Alan Wolfe's latest book, The Future of Liberalism, in front of two incisive critics, Mary Bilder and Daniel Mahoney. And Professor Wolfe will be responding to them. That's in this room April 29th at 4:30 p.m. And we also have a series of lunch colloquia that bring people to talk about work in progress here. And this year, our next one, we have five more this semester. Our next one is with nursing professor Rosanna DeMarco next Thursday. I hope some of you can join us for that. Details for all of these events and all sorts of resources about those events and all the ones preceding them are always available at our website, bc.edu/Boisy. But you are here, however, to engage today's topic, realism, ethics, and U.S. foreign policy. Realism is a school of thought in international relations that asserts the need to carefully assess and project national power to achieve maximum stability and security among states. Realism is commonly contrasted with liberalism or idealism, international relations theories that are putatively more attentive to the role of ideas, ethics, and international institutions, as opposed to state power and collective self-interest. But as our panelists, each of whom identifies him or herself as a realist of some sort, have demonstrated in their own work, there are many kinds of realism that take careful heed of moral considerations in international relations. It's no coincidence that all of our panelists are admirers of, and indeed carefully nuanced scholars of, theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. And in fact, I considered subtitling the panel, "What Would Niebuhr Do?" Niebuhr was a powerful presence in mid-20th century American public life as a proponent of what he called Christian realism, which combined a theological understanding of human nature and sin with a realistic appraisal of the inescapability of power politics in international affairs. He counseled against American triumphalism and revealed the deeply ambivalent moral implications of the responsibility to act in world affairs. And Niebuhr has received quite a renaissance in recent years, with President Obama appearing in some interviews as the chief Niebuhrian-in-chief, if you will. And this renaissance, I think our panelists would agree, is rather appropriate, given his enduring relevance. In fact, Niebuhr's 1952 book, The Irony of American History, was recently reissued by the University of Chicago Press with a memorable introduction by Andrew Bezovich, which says at one point, simply put, this is the most important book ever written on American foreign policy. Now, President Obama has said in his inaugural address that he rejects as false the trade-off between our values and securities, and here lies the central question of political realism, ethics, and U.S. foreign policy. I expect we'll be talking somewhat about the Obama doctrine today and many other hot topics. So let me move on to introduce our panelists in the order in which they'll speak. Andrew Bezovich is professor of history and international relations at Boston University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, and a retired colonel in the United States Army. He received his PhD in American diplomatic history from Princeton University. Before joining the faculty of BU, Boston University, in 1998, he taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. He's the author, most recently, of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, last year, which was preceded by two other important books on similar themes, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, and American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. A member of the Council on Foreign Relations, his essays and reviews have appeared in a wide array of scholarly and general interest publications, from the Atlantic to the London Review of Books to the New Republic, Wall Street Journal, just to name a few. So welcome, Professor Bezovich. I'll introduce the others as well so we can move promptly in between them. Professor Jean Beth Gielstein is the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago, where she holds appointments in the Divinity School, Political Science Department, and the Committee on International Relations. During the fall semester, she holds the Thomas and Dorothy Levy Chair in the Foundations of American Freedom at Georgetown University. Professor Elstein is a political philosopher who examines the connections between our political and ethical convictions. In addition to her essays in numerous journals of civic opinion, she's the editor of 7 books and author of more than a dozen, including Public Man, Private Woman, Democracy on Trial, Augustine and the Limits of Politics, and Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. Her most recent book, published last year, is entitled Sovereignty, God, State, and Society, and it's an early version of which was delivered as the prestigious Gifford Lectures in Edinburgh in 2006. Professor Elstein is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and in 2006 was appointed by President George Bush to the Council of the National Endowment for Humanities. Her PhD in political science is from Brandeis University. So welcome, Professor Elstein. And Reverend J. Brian Hare is the Parker Gilbert Montgomery Professor of the Practice of Religion and Public Life at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and he is the Secretary for Health Care and Social Services in the Archdiocese of Boston. His research and writing focuses on issues of ethics and foreign policy, Catholic social teaching, and the role of religion in world politics and in American society. Apropos of our conversation today, he's the author of numerous influential articles on realism, military intervention, sovereignty, and the ethics of war and peace. Father Harris served as president and CEO of Catholic Charities USA, faculty member and dean of Harvard Divinity School, and before that, Georgetown, on the faculty at Georgetown University. He was a staff member at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, where he played a key role in drafting the influential Catholic Bishops' Statement on Nuclear Weapons in 1983. He's recipient of numerous honors, including a MacArthur Fellowship and honorary degrees from more than 25 institutions. His PhD is from Harvard Divinity School. Welcome, Professor Hare. So, as you can see, we have an extraordinarily distinguished panel today. Each of our panelists will have about 15 minutes for their opening remarks, with the remaining 45 or 40 minutes or so turned over to you for conversation and dialogue on an issue of utmost importance. So let's get started with Professor Bezevich.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and it's certainly a great honor to appear on a panel with such distinguished intellectuals. I sort of, we're on the verge of baseball season here, and baseball fans will appreciate that my role really is to sort of serve up that soft hanging curve so that the big hitters are going to stride up to the plate and knock it out of here. I think my own remarks will be very brief. You will remember on January 20th, on Inauguration Day, you will specifically remember this January 20th, Inauguration Day, when Justice Roberts helped President Obama mangle the presidential oath of office. I think that was actually a very salutary mistake, because it focused our attention on something that we would otherwise, I think, have quickly passed over, namely the words, the text of the oath that the president was supposed to take. And that oath, in that oath, President Obama swore, quote, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. The oath taken by other federal officials and by serving U.S. military officers is quite similar. The administering of this oath is not simply the occasion for a photo op or for expressions of lofty rhetoric. It signifies a solemn commitment and a contract. Here, I would argue, lies the distilled essence of any official's moral obligation. The oath of office explicitly defines that obligation not in relation to the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount, much less the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but in relation to the Constitution. Now, as an individual who professes a Christian identity, Barack Obama may well have a personal obligation to respond to the needs of his fellow humans on the other side of the world. After all, the Lord has commanded us to love our neighbor. To the extent that Obama, as an individual, wishes to devote himself in a private capacity to such efforts, and to the extent that he wishes to spend his own money for such purposes, he will certainly deserve our admiration, and really will set an example for the rest of us. But that's not what he was elected president to do. Note that the oath of office does not summon the president to eliminate tyranny, make the world safe for democracy, or eradicate the evils that have afflicted mankind since God banished Adam and his partner from the Garden of Eden. When they drafted their compact in 1787, the framers had more modest, if by no means trivial, purposes in mind. They enunciated those purposes in another text that typically receives too little attention, namely the preamble to the Constitution. Here we find the definitive expression of the Constitution's enduring purpose, which is, again to quote, to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Now, I have to say, as a kid growing up, I always sort of viewed the preamble of the Constitution as kind of a throat-clearing exercise, you know, that the people who drafted this document felt they had to put down some fancy words before they got to the heart of the matter, beginning in with Article 1. I've since revisited that notion and believe that, in fact, the words stated in the preamble are stated because they do, in fact, reflect the intent of the framers. Now, in their wisdom, the framers did not define union, justice, tranquility, welfare, and liberty. Arguments over the meaning of these values have constituted the lifeblood of American politics. These arguments continue today. Yet I would assert the following. As long as the aspirations stated in the preamble remain unfulfilled, then the central moral imperative of U.S. policy is to make good on that deficiency. If our own people do not enjoy justice or the blessings of liberty, then the oath of office imposes on officials a moral obligation to focus their attention on these shortcomings. That is what they were elected to do. Their obligation is to us. Now, at the present moment, two particular parts of the preamble merit particular attention, in my view. The first has to do with the preamble's reference to posterity. The second has to do with its reference to the common defense. No definition of moral obligation can qualify as worthy of the name unless it takes into account our collective obligation to future generations. Yet the actual practice of American politics in our day has ignored or slighted the interest of prosperity. On everything from fiscal policy to entitlements, to the environment, to energy policy, we have privileged the present at the expense of the future. By refusing to live within our means, we are saddling generations to come with intolerable burdens. This practice is not only wrong, but also fundamentally at odds with the oath that the president and other federal officials take. Securing the blessed of livings to posterity, making it possible for future generations to enjoy what we have had in our past, necessarily requires, among other things, a balanced budget, a cap on entitlements, alleviation of the current account deficit, an end to our dependence on foreign oil, and the restoration of the environment and its protection from further harm. A big agenda, an agenda that I think is in tension with hopes or expectations on the part of others that we should go out and fix the world's problems. I do not mean to imply that the matters in this big agenda are to be dispatched with the wave of a hand. Although President Obama may well be, as is commonly said, the most powerful man in the world, none of these problems will be fully resolved on his watch. Yet we owe it to posterity to begin now. To postpone action further is intolerable. Indeed, should we persist in refusing to act, future generations will condemn our selfishness and our profligacy, and we will roundly deserve that condemnation. Then there is the matter of what the Constitution refers to as the common defense. In an era when U.S. military spending outstrips the rest of the world combined, and U.S. forces specialize in global power projection, when the Pentagon maintains a network of bases around the world, and our soldiers fight perpetual wars in distant and obscure places, and when few Americans even bat an eyelash when contemplating these facts, the very phrase common defense from the Constitution has something of an antique ring to it. In present-day Washington, the preferred term is national security, a concept imbued with enormous and deeply problematic elasticity. Bluntly, as that concept, the concept of national security, has evolved over the past 60 years or so, it has become a rationale for global hegemony, and a recipe for immensely costly and debilitating military interventionism. I mean, interventionism that, again, is at odds with our obligation to posterity. Rather than being fixed, the imperatives of national security turn out to be infinitely expansible. Therefore, the exertions required to satisfy those imperatives are endless. In Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, President Obama has inherited some of the consequences. He has promised to extricate the country from Iraq. For reasons that remain obscure, at least to me, he seems intent on plunging more deeply into the other two active fronts of the so-called war on terror. I personally urge him to look before making that leap into the unknown, although I guess I should have urged him yesterday, since today we announced 17,000 more troops going to Afghanistan. He ought, in my judgment, to consider this possibility, that the concept of national security and all the assumptions, routines, institutions, and policies implied by that phrase has become incompatible with his moral obligation to the American people. To put it another way, the pursuit of truly moral policies here at home, those consistent with the oath that he took on January 20th, may well require that he jettison the concept of national security abroad. My basic proposition is this one. The common good requires the common defense. The revival of military practices more akin to what the authors of the Constitution intended. Now, the founding fathers were by no means pacifists. After all, to win their independence, Americans relied on the sustained use of violence. The founders did not doubt the utility of armed force. They simply viewed that utility as limited. Even as they set out to make the United States a great nation, they remained wary of relying excessively on military power, a concern expressed in their aversion to what they called standing armies. In our own time, we've abandoned such thinking as retrograde or obsolete and have come to see force as our strong suit. We've committed ourselves to a policy that aims at maintaining a position of permanent military supremacy, not strength, supremacy. We've embraced practices and policies that in others we would be quick to denounce as evidence of militarism. The Bush doctrine of preventive war offers one especially egregious example of this tendency. What would it mean in practical terms to abandon the ideology of national security and content ourselves with providing for the common defense? For starters, it would mean abrogating the Bush doctrine and reviving the tradition that sees force as a last resort to be employed for defensive purposes only. It would mean giving up on the notion that hard power provides an effective and affordable instrument for transforming or pacifying the Islamic world. It would mean devising a completely different scale for answering the classic question, how much is enough? It would mean restoring the connection between citizenship and military service. It would mean shifting resources away from the Pentagon and toward those agencies that specialize in what Secretary of State Clinton refers to as smart power. It would mean taming the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about. I don't honestly expect the Obama administration to do any of these things. The forces of inertia are great indeed. I do suggest that as long as we continue to subscribe to the perverse doctrines of national security that in Washington passed for the received wisdom, that any serious pursuit of a morally coherent foreign policy will remain an illusion. Not only because our policies are so frequently at odds with the well-being of others, but because they are also at odds with the well-being of the people Obama was elected to serve. Thank you very much.
Well, I think we just heard from a heavy hitter, even though he professes not to be one. So thank you for those comments. Within the world of the academic study of international relations, the word realism means power politics shorn from normative and ethical restraint. A statesman can be cautious or not, as the case may be, but strictly on power lines. Do I have the power to carry out this threat? Do I have the power to accomplish this mission? Do I have the power to get my allies to go along with me? And so on. Ethical considerations do not enter into it. Power politics, on this view, realist politics, cannot be made to subscribe to nor to conform to ethical criteria. Now, foreign policy from time to time may make common cause with certain ethical norms, but this is neither a necessity nor a requirement. The only consideration, finally, is who has power over whom and what and to what ends. Any limits set, any of the limits that are set are set by power considerations, not by ethical restraints. Now, if there is an ethic in this, as many have argued, it is a pre-Christian ethic of sorts. There are some who've written about the return to a kind of pagan ethic that they associate with the antique world. But it is an ethic not hemmed in by what the civic Republicans historically called the effeminizing tendencies of Christianity. So according to Machiavelli, one of those civic Republicans, one can feign honesty, one can act the part of the generous statesman, one can proclaim that one is telling the truth, but this is all likely to be an act. He says it's fine if you can authentically be all these things, but finally, again, what counts is seizing and holding power. And indeed, the statesman who tries to abide by ethical strictures is more likely to endanger his people because the rest of the world is not behaving that way. Christians are lambs to the slaughter, opined Rousseau, another civic Republican, some centuries after Machiavelli. He too talked about the effeminizing consequences of Christianity, and he argued that Christianity is basically a lousy civic religion because it puts people at odds with themselves. They'll wind up with moral conflict between what religion requires of them and what the state demands. In his view, what is required is a stalwart civic religion, one in which I gaze upon the patria from the moment of birth and, in a sense, love the state. The state gets sacralized, in a sense. Now, in one of his texts, Rousseau offers his power politics definition, if you will, of the female citizen. I call this in my book on women in war a story of the Spartan mother image. There's a Spartan mother who's awaiting news of a battle, and a slave comes to inform her of what's happened, and he says, "I have very bad news. Your five sons were killed." And the Spartan mother slaps the slave and says, "Base slave, did I ask you that? Who won the battle?" And the slave replies, "Sparta." Rousseau tells us the mother goes to the temple and gives thanks to the gods and this is the female citizen. So women match men in their civic ferocity in this vision, and in their preparedness to shun the softening tendencies of Christianity or any other ethic that sets up norms and standards for human political behavior. Now, this is the backdrop to contemporary realism of the sort that prevails in the academic study of international relations. There is a particular epistemology at work here that you'll be relieved to know I'm not going to go into, but the upshot finally is that you can somehow sanitize both your politics and your political analysis, especially in foreign policy, from any taint by norms or values inappropriate to the exercise of power in the international arena. One must evaluate foreign policy then exclusively in the language of power politics and national interest, and yet, at the same time, if we look back to what Professor Basevich talked about, our founding, you had the founders who recoiled in some deep sense from the old dynastic politics of Europe. That was the thing that they weren't going to be. And in writing the Constitution, which we've already heard about, you find the certain norms and values, ethics that are embedded in the document itself. So we wouldn't be naive about power, but there is an essential, not an accidental or arbitrary dimension, ethical dimension to the conduct of human affairs, of human political affairs, both domestic and foreign. Now, because America was founded on certain universal principles, inevitably those principles seep over into our dealings with other nations. Not that Americans could not or did not play the power game then, they did and they could, but U.S. foreign policy makers did not affect the sanitizing of politics from values that contemporary realism, neorealism, demands and assumes. We talk about national interest, but is that national interest reducible merely to a kind of collective self-interest, or is there something more, something richer involved? Might one instead describe national interest as having a moral and ethical dimension? That is one way critics have tried to challenge realist presuppositions. Or some say that you can have this notion of national interest sort of narrowly construed, and then there's a track of ethics and values, and sometimes these tracks cross one another and intersect. I think it's more fruitful by far to see ethics as themselves constitutive of the way the United States construes its national interest. Moral reason giving then has rarely been eschewed altogether in the operation of U.S. foreign policy. Just thinking back to the World War II era, you find the way that that turned into a moral crusade. I'm thinking of FDR's D-Day prayer, of Dwight Eisenhower as a commander in Europe, writing his book in the aftermath called Crusade in Europe, and he had in mind a moral crusade against the evils of Nazism. We can think perhaps of some moments where narrow national interest was involved. Maybe Nixon's opening to China, that seems pretty exclusively a matter of self-interest and pure balance of power politics. It meant looking the other way where horrific human rights abuses were concerned. But that's, we could debate those cases. So perhaps what we require is a richer view of realism, one that would wrest it from the narrow construals that prevail in the study of international relations today. If this is the task we undertake, then Christian realism, as it's called, is a good place to start. So what is Christian about that position called Christian realism? For one thing, a key point is that the ethics of Jesus cannot, in fact, provide a complete social and political ethics, but that does not mean there's no place for ethics derived from and shaped by Christian commitment. And that commitment is not just to a certain version of political realism, but to moral realism and theological realism as well. The view over simply is that there really are defensible moral claims for which strong truth warrants exist. that moral claims are not just expressions of emotion, but they're the articulation of norms that can be either true or false. Again, we enter heavy waters here, so let me summarize by saying that the truth of moral claims depends in part on whether they can provide the most comprehensive and accurate account of states of affairs in the world. So in the Christian realism position, you have a number of realisms that cohere, that come together, and moral judgments from that framework help to adjudicate divergent interests. That is, moral claims are not just an emphatic way of stating what one wants. Moral claims are based on knowledge of the needs and constraints essential to human life. Now, given the complexities of the human situation, a moral ideal alone cannot articulate what we ought to do. One must look at possible consequences as well. So realism implies recognition of the limits of moral solutions to political problems. The limits, not just the possibilities. There's a huge difference between that and moralisms as dogmatically held and to be applied no matter what the consequences might be. Big difference between these accounts. We are dealing with proximate moral choices. So strong ideals can never be met fully. This does not mean, however, that one dispenses with ethics altogether. So Christian realism is a combination of different realisms that, taken together, provide, as Professor Robin Lovin in some of his excellent writing on this subject is called, a combination of self-criticism and critical thinking. Puts together political realism skepticism about overreach and tough-mindedness about power, even as the theological virtue of hope is held up. There may be transformative possibilities in political life, and it's very difficult to separate ethical dimensions from these transformative possibilities. We can certainly see this in the domestic life of our own society. You cannot talk about the civil rights movement of the 1960s without seeing the way in which it was from the beginning to the end a set of moral and ethical, involved a set of moral and ethical claims drawn directly from scripture, from the prophets and so forth, and then fused with certain themes in American life. So this stance, I would say, provides a more adequate understanding of contemporary events than those that rest on less comprehensive visions. I have one more example here, but I'm well aware of the time. So let me sort of foreshorten this example. If you look at, if we're thinking about international affairs, if you look at the changes in Central Eastern Europe that culminated in the peaceful revolutions of 1989, you cannot account for those events, especially in Poland, without looking at the role of Pope John Paul II. And the way in which moral force, if you will, was fungible, spurred political action. When I was in Poland in 1983, they were under martial law. It was John Paul's second pilgrimage back to his homeland. And I asked Poles, what does he offer to you? And they said, hope. It's hope. Hope that this could change. Hope that this might be different. And John Paul walked a very fine line there between understating possibilities and then people would lose hope, or overstating them and then they might undertake reckless action that might invite, if you will, the tanks from Moscow to roam into Warsaw. But hope was a big part of it. This can change. This can be different. So one profound benefit of taking religion and morality seriously is that one is less likely to treat complex realities in a reductionistic way where statements of value and claims of morality and faith are concerned. Once in a while, people actually do mean it. Now, as many of you know, and I'm going to start winding down here, if you mention Christian realism, the name Reinhold Niebuhr follows fast upon. Niebuhr insisted that no political regime or system can ever eliminate conflict. It is a pervasive feature of human life. But what sort of conflict and to what ends? And how do we evaluate means and ends in any case? Success cannot be the only criterion. What Christian realism does then is to limit the scope of all political claims. Again, that cautionary note. This is valid against all political systems, for all are tempted by grandiosities and overreach at different points in their history. And we could point to one example after another of that. And I'll skip over the examples here in the interest of time. Now, America is obviously not exempt from some of these grandiosities. We have we have our own furies and our own temptations, because some of these have been cast in the mold of moralism, if not moral triumphalism. Many, again, have said it's far better to take the morality and the ethics out. That's too volatile. And if we keep it in, it might lead to something that is usually decried as Wilsonianism. The view is that President Wilson overstated everything about the possibilities in the Treaty of Versailles, the ending of World War I, we're going to make the world safe for democracy, and so on, and that wound up being rather catastrophic. So that's always the example pointed to when morality gets into the picture, as if that's the only way that that could be done. So this overreaction, I think, is of very little help as one assesses the present moment, because Americans will always bring certain moral principles and purposes into play when they think about politics, whether domestic or foreign. So the question is, what principles, to what ends, how do we evaluate these critically? And what Reinhold Niebuhr did was to help several generations of Americans to do just that. Now, I hope I haven't cast this at too abstract a level. I wanted to get some kind of conceptual framework on the table at the beginning, hoping that this might better assist our thinking about discriminate judgments we make on specific aspects of American foreign policy, historic and current. So with Professor Basevich, I look forward very much to the discussion with my colleagues and to your questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me first say, coming back to Boston College is always a trifecta. It's a pleasure to come back to this university, which does so much for the city and for the Archdiocese of Boston. It's secondly always a pleasure because you put together wonderful panels, so today I'm able to celebrate with two colleagues that I've learned from often during and consistently during my own professional career. And thirdly, you talk about serious issues. So therefore, on all of those counts, I'm grateful to be part of this program. I was also grateful thinking about the fact that I would be talking to a room full of students and professors, because you would have shared my experience in getting ready for this panel. When I tried the first draft of what I wanted to do, being asked to speak about realism, ethics, and how realism might contribute to the Obama administration, that was our charge in a sense, general charge, I looked at the first draft and I found out that I was totally unoriginal about realism and purely speculative about Obama. And so therefore I began to wonder about what I was going to have to offer. So I tried to step back into some modest confines and see if I could offer some ideas that would join my two colleagues and then leave it open for you. So let me do the following things. I want to talk first about forms of realism, or what you might call representations of realism. Secondly, a word about ethics and realism in light of those various representations. And then thirdly, the new administration and what realism might or might not contribute to its work. The difficulty with being original about realism is that except for the great religious traditions, there are few other traditions that have been examined as consistently as the theme we are examining today. The history of this debate at least is from the 5th century BC up through the present moment. And so that constant examination, understandably, has fine-tuned the problematic for anyone who turns to an analysis of it. Like any good tradition, realism encompasses a multiplicity of representations. Like any good tradition, a tradition encompasses more than one theory, more than one way of expressing the central truths of the tradition. For my part, I distinguish three kinds of realism: classical realism, modern realism, and then a theme that I won't address at any length, neorealism. Classical realism is, I think, perhaps easily synthesized if we draw on Michael Walzer's opening chapter of his wonderful book on just and unjust wars. Any of you who have used that book knows that Walzer entitles his first chapter Against Realism. And so, reflecting what Professor Elstein has just said, Walzer really argues that unless he can contain the claims of realism, there won't be any room for him to write on the ethics of war. But for my purposes, the Walzer piece is useful in exemplifying the meaning of classical realism. The people belonging in this category include Thucydides, Hobbes, and Machiavelli. And as many of you know, Professor Walzer adds the footnote that Hobbes was the one who translated Thucydides. But more importantly, he captures the meaning of classical realism in the famous dialogue that you find in the Peloponnesian Wars, the Malayan Dialogue. The setting, as you know, is that Athens is the superpower of the world. Melos is a troublesome colony, and Athens is about to put Melos in its place for its relationships with Sparta and the fact that it is troublesome. The Athenian generals, therefore, go the night before the battle, or at least before the battle, to encounter their adversaries. And essentially, they say to their adversaries the following. They say, "Come now, let us have no talk about justice. Let us make no claims on your part that we should be restrained by justice. Let us have no talk about justice. Let us talk about the world as it is, realism. And in the world as it is, the strong do what they will and the weak do what they must." Now, that proposition of realism, which adequately, I think, does express classical realism, needs to be examined in two steps. One need not think that the Athenian generals are totally devoid of moral sentiment, of conscience, or of obeying moral restraint in much of their life. Indeed, in many parts of their life, in friendships, in family relationships, as citizens, they may well abide by moral and legal norms. But the proposition they express is that in one particular area of life, international politics, if we wish to use a modern term, and specifically war, there is no room for restraint in that area of life. The stakes of war, the definition of war, the methods of war are such that there simply is no room for restraint, for placing yourself in a position to try to understand your adversary's situation. There is nothing to be done except to proceed forward and to conquer what must be conquered. Classical realism. Modern realism is represented in the United States by three icons. The people that emerged at the end of World War II, namely Hans Morgenthau, George Kennan, and Reinhold Niebuhr. And these three people then created a tradition of thinking about American foreign policy, both academically and diplomatically, which has then produced the substantial legacy. The names run across the policy-making times of America, of post-World War II American foreign policy. Indeed, as has already been noted, no less than three presidents claim Reinhold Niebuhr as a guide: Jimmy Carter, William Clinton, and now President Obama. But the names cut across others, from Acheson onward, and then through the American academic community. I was reading yesterday a survey that had been done of professors of international relations in the United States, and the dominant tradition to which most adhere is realism. The neorealists, I think, are not so relevant to our discussion. Represented in the writing of Kenneth Walsh, it is really about a theory of international relations and how you structure it, and while there are realist conclusions and premises, it is not relevant to our discussion. So it is the modern realists, I think, that are interesting, because they were not willing to be tarred with the brush of classical realism. certainly indebted to premises of classical realism, they were not willing to be tarred with the argument that they didn't think there was any place for, any room for, or any possibility of ethical restraint in foreign policy. So the question about the modern realists, I think, and their legacy is really quite relevant for us today because their legacy is both intellectual and political. The modern realists sought to create space for ethics within the context of a realist vision of the world. Now, in pursuit of that objective, they varied in their success. I think Niebuhr was the most successful because he was the most sophisticated when you came to this question. Morgenthau was often tarred with the argument that he had a view of politics that had no ethics in it, but that's unfair if you read a good deal of his writing. Kennan is the most difficult. He first expunges any notion of ethics from foreign policy. Then during the nuclear age, he becomes a super morally committed individual who argues that the only position a Christian could have is pacifism. And then he writes another article in 1984 which says it's really impossible to think about ethics and foreign policy. So Niebuhr clearly is the choice, I suppose, of all three of us as someone who seriously engages both the realist tradition and a sense of moral argument. Now, what do the realists fear about ethics and foreign policy? I think realists fear three things. They fear complexity, they fear consequences, and they fear crusades. That is to say, they fear that if you try to systematically embed a moral vision in an overall policy vision, you will run up against these three hurdles. The first hurdle is complexity. The argument is foreign policy is complex enough as it is. If you try to get states people to think about ethics and all the rest of the complexity, all you will end up with is simplistic foreign policy that doesn't take seriously the nature of the world and the issues you try to solve. Combined with that is the fear of consequences. That is to say, the fear of good intentions producing bad consequences. And you can find examples of exactly this phenomenon and know why the realists both fear not adequate attention to complexity and why they fear good intentions producing bad consequences. The third thing, of course, is crusades, in which they say if statespeople really take moral norms seriously, what you will end up with is not a fine-tuned tension between the normative and the empirical, not a fine-tuned shaping of power by moral norms, you will end up with crusades. Crusades either for religion in the past or crusades for democracy and human rights today. So complexity, consequences, and crusades give the realists a sense that there's room for ethics, but not a lot. They don't deny the relevance of ethical vision, but I would argue they seek to contain it. And they see ethics as, in a sense, at the edge of the policy equation rather than in the center. Realism thinks of ethics, I think, as a second-order consideration after other considerations of power have been attended to. At least that's where it can slip in spite of their intention. Now, there is in realism, at the same time, great truth. There is the truths of realism, I think, are about actors in international affairs, about relationships in international affairs, and about limits in international affairs. Realists are clear-headed about actors and who the dominant actors are in an international system. They are clear-headed and have been in the modern period about the centrality of states as directing forces in international affairs. Secondly, they are clear about relationships. Relationships among states in the context of a, quotes, anarchical system, a term they love, are relationships that are governed by power and interest. And finally, realists are clear-headed about limits. The world of world politics is a world of duress. It is a world characterized by necessity, not by open-ended possibilities. Or at least possibilities are to be measured by the necessities that have to be met in world politics. Realism has truth, realism has limits. The limits of realism, in my mind, are two. Their definition of the scope of responsibility of states, statespersons, etc. And secondly, that realism can easily be a captive of consequentialism in their moral vision. The scope of responsibility, I think, is best posited by looking at a document that is at home in a Catholic university, and that is Pacem in Terris of John the 23rd. Realists begin their definition of the world with states, the fundamental actors, and everything is built from that. John the 23rd begins his definition of the world as a human community which happens to be governed by states. So while there is plenty of room to take states seriously, states always have relative moral value, never absolute moral value. Let me close, then, by turning to my speculative part of the reflection, namely, does realism have anything to say to the new administration and to President Obama? Let me say a word about the world before him, the nation behind him, and his policy choices. The world before him, the world that he faces, the definition of the international system, will it yield to a realist vision? That is to say, is a realist vision adequate to interpret the world that the United States faces today? I think realism will help him to interpret some very important things. Again, the role of states, power, relationships. But I don't think the world will yield to a purely realist vision. Beyond realism, there is a framework of international relations that realism does not always capture. Their concentration on the importance of states often blinds them to the importance of other frameworks and other actors in world politics. The logic of force, at which they are very much at home, is a different logic than the logic of finance, for example. The realist conception of the logic of force is almost always a zero-sum game. In terms of international financial institutions, a logic that is purely a zero-sum game risks bringing the whole system down upon all of us. And so there is a way in which realism, I think, will not define the world totally for this administration. The nation behind the president, there is clearly a sense of the primacy of the domestic. We have heard a strong case for it from Professor Bacevich. But I would want to argue that it would be impossible for the United States to be purely concerned with domestic. One of the unfortunate terms that came out of the Clinton administration was that the United States was the indispensable nation. This certainly is Niebuhrian hubris at work. But while I would not agree that the United States is the indispensable nation, it is a necessary nation. That is to say, it is a sine qua non for any conception of international order. We must be part of the agenda. So the policy choices that the administration faces, will realism help at all? Well, he has inherited a policy legacy that was not realist. In spite of the fact that the previous administration had people in it who declared themselves to be realist, a realist sense of limits, a realist sense of the difficulty of hubris, were certainly not present in the way their policy was defined or implemented. So Obama inherits three wars, and he will have to think about leaving one, engaging another, and redefining the third. Leaving Iraq. The question at issue is under what conditions, in what terms, and to go back to an earlier panel we had here, have we acquired responsibilities in Iraq, even if you totally disagreed with entry? I think the entry was the worst foreign policy mistake in the 20th century. I do think we've now got responsibilities that are not easily dispensed. Engaging Afghanistan, I have the same sense of limits, maybe born of realism, that Professor Bacevich has. And redefining the war on terror is necessary in order to free American foreign policy from an overly constrained conception of itself. Beyond war, policy choices can be guided, I think, usefully by some realism, because part of our problem in making our foreign policy Iraq and Afghanistan and the transformation of the Middle East is we leave out the rest of the globe. And realism believes that relationships among great powers is a dominant force in world politics. We need to get back to some of that business. And finally, there is the world beyond the state and the use of force, into a realm of larger institutions, international in nature, multinational in nature, and into a range of issues that cut across human rights and human welfare, as well as war, peace, and the state.
All right. Can everybody hear me with this mic? Yes? Okay. Well, thank you very much to three terrific presentations. I'm very much inclined to turn the conversation to the floor unless there's a burning desire to respond to one another directly, because this is always the most frothy portion of a panel like this. So we have theoretical concerns and statements on the table. We have policy questions on the table. And the floor is yours to engage at any of these levels that have been brought up. Yes, John.
Yes. I was struck by one aspect of your effort to conceptualize Christian realism,
yes,
which I appreciated. And that is when you said that it provides for a more comprehensive manner of reflection, yep, about moral considerations. Yep. How does adding Christian to realism provide for a more comprehensive manner of reflecting when many Americans aren't Christian, and perhaps increasingly so?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it limit the whole question?
Right. Well, first of all, the empirical fact that there's a growing number in our population that does not profess Christianity, I think doesn't necessarily pertain to the first part of your question. That is to say, you've got an overwhelmingly Christian heritage in the United States that is going to ineluctably have some profound consequences for the conduct of a political life, domestic and foreign. So we could talk about what difference it makes as you become more plural religiously to the articulation of a neighborian Christian realism, if you will. So the claim I made had to do with the fact that if we decide we can really expunge certain ethical and moral considerations from our understanding of a complex social and political reality, we will fail to comprehend that reality in its totality or its comprehensiveness, that you have to put that into the explanatory framework in a systematic way. So Christian realism is one way of doing that, given the insistence on the fact that moral claims, again, are either true or false, and that we can assess the truth or the falsity of those claims. So if you look at Christian realism, it's a very complicated thing because it partakes of the political realism that we heard Father Hare talk about in its different varieties, modern neorealism, modern realism, and classical realism, draws from those. But at the same time, you've got to put into the mix these daunting issues of moral realism and theological realism as well. And here, let me just recommend to you Robin Lovin's book on Reinhold Niebuhr and Christian realism. I think he does that as well as any text that I've seen. So all of that, again, is in the backdrop. And I think that the proof is in the pudding in a way. So if we look at the way in which those within the camp of Christian realism understood some of the political realities of their time, I think that arguably one would give the edge to them as having a more accurate assessment of the perils and possibilities of a particular situation than did others, whether fellow Christians or in some cases, more hardcore realists in another instance. Let me give you one example. And then I will cease and desist. The example is the period in between World Wars I and II. And what Niebuhr was up against was an overwhelming sentiment in the Christian community, sort of loosely defined, as articulated in dominant journals of the time, that the United States should stay out altogether of what was happening in Europe, that we had no business there, that there was no difference in principle between National Socialist Germany and the British Empire. They were both sort of nasty things, so a kind of moral equivalence argument, and pushing again a type of sort of quasi-pacifism to the point of even ignoring, in some cases, the information that was coming out of Germany about what was happening to the Jewish people and so forth, just downplaying that. So that version of Christian moral thinking, ignoring the realities, the tough realities of the situation, is what Niebuhr positioned himself against. And he moved from being a membership of something called the Fellowship for Reconciliation to becoming an advocate of the need for the United States to, as he said, to prevent the victory of an intolerable tyranny, in his words. So I think if you went back and looked at some of those documents, you would see that you need both Christian and realism in there to account for the comprehensive understanding that Niebuhr had of that situation.
But there are lots of other parties who are also arguing in favor of dealing with what's happening in Germany.
Well, the other... and
have nothing to do with
Christianity. Well, the other side of that, in addition to his interlocutors within the Christian community thought were completely off base by ignoring the realities of what was going on, you would have to put in those who were in favor of intervention and what their arguments were, and if they adequately understood, and Niebuhr clearly believed that some of them didn't, adequately understood what was really at stake, that it wasn't a matter of the European balance of power. I mean, that was in there, but it wasn't exclusively a matter of that. There were larger issues at stake that you could only understand in an ethical and a moral vocabulary. So if you didn't proffer that, then you had a somewhat inadequate understanding of the situation. I don't know if that helps at all, but I'm sure you're not entirely persuaded, but that's the best I can do at the moment.
Yes, other questions? Yes.
Yeah, this question is for whoever. Because of America's national security stance, because of our nuclear umbrella, Europe today isn't engaging in arms races. It's not dragging the world into world wars like it did twice before, and it's basically building itself a pacifist socialist utopia. So how ethical would it be to give all that up by abandoning our stance?
For whom to give it up?
For us to give up our heavy-handed ideas of national security.
Well, I'll leap in very briefly, because I want to hear from my colleagues. But Europe received, in a sense, a great gift from us after World War II, which is that we provided for their common defense, and they enjoyed a kind of peace benefit because they knew that the United States was pledged to their security with NATO and under the kind of nuclear umbrella, so to speak. So there's an undeniable benefit they drew from that, and I think you would have to, you'd have to take a hard look at. You could imagine a counterfactual situation where the United States hadn't done that. What would have happened in Europe? Kind of imagine that out. But you could also start to reflect on the current moment, and I think President Obama. This is one of the issues he's going to have to deal with. He's already starting to deal with it, which is to get the Europeans to pony up a bit more. Get more. Folks involved in the Afghanistan war, for them to, in a sense, to bear more of the burden, because they certainly have the economic capacity to do that. So he's urging them along these lines, and I don't see that suddenly coming to a halt. I mean, it's entirely consistent with, it seems to me, with his view of the world insofar as I understand it, which is that one should avoid moralistic crusades, to make the world safe for democracy. But at the same time, there are real issues that involve, again, moral and ethical concerns about the sorts of things that you want to hold back or to defeat or to prevent from spreading. And his mission, in part, is to try to bring the Europeans more into that in a more active way, as I understand it. But I could be off. Brian, I don't know. What do you think? Andy?
Well, I mean, my own view would be that Europe is pacified. Europe is debellicized. and that process is probably all but irreversible.
Yeah.
Whereas it was emphatically in our national interest to make a commitment to the defense of Europe in the aftermath of World War II, that's no longer necessary, given that, in my judgment at least, we are vastly overcommitted and overstretched. There's a mismatch between our commitments and the power that we have available to meet those commitments. It really becomes necessary for us to examine which of those commitments have now become redundant. And I think the defense of Europe probably is item number one in that list. Now, the Europeans, with American encouragement, since the end of the Cold War, have been engaged in a project to try to reinvent NATO, which requires inventing new missions for NATO. This initially took an expression in the NATO out-of-area interventions in the Balkans. More recently, it's taken an expression in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization sending troops to Central Asia, where they have performed, by most accounts, not at all well. President Obama, I think, and certainly Secretary Gates,
yeah.
even in the last administration,
yeah.
The American SACEUR, everybody's beating on the Europeans, saying, send more troops to Afghanistan and remove some of the political constraints on the employment of those NATO Europe troops. The Germans would be a big case. My own view is it ain't going to happen. The political will to provide an effective European NATO force in Afghanistan doesn't exist. The wherewithal doesn't exist. And so we're asking NATO to do something that it wasn't designed to do and isn't capable to do. I believe NATO should return to its founding mission, which was the defense of Europe, which, as I said, they can do without our assistance. So NATO should come out of Afghanistan, should go back to Europe, should attend to the threat that exists, which is a relatively modest but nonetheless real Russian threat, and we should extricate ourselves from NATO and insist that Europe take responsibility for its own well-being.
The Europeans couldn't even take care of Kosovo. That was in their own
Yeah.
Well, you know, you extricate us from NATO not by saying, oh, let's see, February 18th, we're out of here by tomorrow. You do it by saying that over the course of the next 5 years, 10 years, I'm not sure what the number is, the United States is going to gradually withdraw its military presence and ultimately will disengage from the military part of the alliance. And it will be incumbent upon the Europeans to adjust accordingly.
My own way of thinking about this is that the defense of Europe in the standard post-World War II period, the situation has just changed. There is the residual question that Professor Basev just raised about where Russia might go, but the highly architecture of the nuclear relationship with NATO at the heart of it is simply, I think, not applicable today. So on the one hand, it was necessary then, I think, and useful as it was in Japan. Japan's a more complicated question because you certainly don't want to start a debate in Japan about the rearmament of Japan. It not only has the danger of tearing apart Japan, but it has the danger of disrupting the East Asian subsystem, which is enormously complicated. So that's the first point. The second point is that while the old problems are gone, there are a set of new problems. And here, it seems to me you run into some real need of ethical discernment and taking questions apart. Professor Basevich and I were on this panel before, and my difficulty with the careful parsing of the presidential oath of office that he does, which is exquisitely done, is that I think it does not exhaust not just the personal moral responsibility of the president, but the definition of the moral responsibility of the United States or any nation. And so I see two questions that have been behind us that need some clarity for the future. The first one is the one where I think we would divide the most on, and it's very difficult to make the case, and that is humanitarian military intervention in the 1990s. I think the world didn't deal with it well then. I think the attempt to deal with it was partially successful. I do not think that question will go away. That is to say, societies imploding and massive human rights violations being committed, and how do you define the wider community? On the other hand, Iraq is defined as an intervention. And if Iraq is defined as an intervention, that will undercut humanitarian intervention for good, because the argument that that, it clearly was not humanitarian. So if unless you can distinguish what happened in Iraq from what I would call the humanitarian intervention case, you're not going to get anywhere on that question. But on the humanitarian intervention case, I think, unfortunately, there will be more than one opportunity to have to face that, and whether it's the Europeans or the United States or others, there are responsibilities that have been built up through the UN, through the documents on human rights, that I'm afraid push the moral framework back to this question of a single community within which there are sovereign states with duties to themselves, but I don't think that exhausts their duties. That's my sense.
And just a quick postscript to that, it seems to me that the ante has really been upped where humanitarian intervention or the occasions for it are concerned with the UN doctrine, if we may call it that, of the responsibility to protect.
Yeah,
don't you think
that
that's...
I think that's still embryonic. I think that's a proposition of some significance, but I don't think it's an agreed upon consensual doctrine in that sense.
Well,
at the present minute.
You've
gotten a Security Council resolution behind it, you've got the millennium, but the bottom line is that I think the international lawyers, some of them are less than impressed by it, and we'll see how it works.
Okay.
Father Hollenbach.
This is really a follow-up on that question, but I formulated in terms of the relation of the realism and the limits on international politics in light of extreme human rights violations. I mean, that's what Brian is bringing up here about humanitarian intervention. But I know, Brian, from what you've written, that you've prepared to justify humanitarian intervention in the face of genocide or real extraordinary state failure or perhaps ethnic cleansing. Those, I think, if I remember correctly, were the three cases that you used. Now, Professor Bacevich said this is not his position, is not going to put the United States in a position of defending human rights around the world. And I'm not quite sure, but I'd be interested to know from Brian Hare, Father Hare, about the limits that you see coming from the realist direction. A lot of realists are going to say the United States is not going to get involved in Darfur. We know that. That's not in our national interest. And from one point of view, that's correct. From another point of view, if someone like the president gets up and says it's a genocide, then we've got a different issue. I'm interested to know how you would approach an issue like Darfur in light of the acknowledgement of limits that you have, and I'd be interested to know where Professor Bacevich stands on that, too.
Well, my way of dealing with it, you've more than adequately stated it. I mean, what I've written on this is I start with the non-intervention principle as a regulating principle in an anarchic world governed by sovereign independent states. I just don't want to make the non-intervention principle an absolute rule. So I treat it as a moral presumption that yields to exceptions. Then I think you have to define your exceptions and find, and it is in the nature, it seems to me, of moral argument that you've got to have sometimes when not every exception counts as an override. So the first for me is genocide. It seems to me that's been fairly strongly asserted in international obligation. Which doesn't necessarily mean we will react to it. We did not in the middle 90s. Secondly, ethnic cleansing. I use that because during the Bosnia debate, people were writing things and saying that it's only ethnic cleansing. So it's not genocide, therefore there's not actionable item. I tended to think the distinction between the two was real, but ethnic cleansing was serious enough. Thirdly, the failed state notion. Now, what I'm not prepared to argue is that human rights violations stated baldly in those terms are an override. Because it seems to me if you argue that human rights violations without further qualification are reasons for military intervention, and then you read Amnesty International, you'd have interventions all over the world all the time. And then I think that's exactly what the realists tell you, that that becomes a crusade, the consequences become overwhelmingly mixed, if not negative. And so I wouldn't use that. Final point in this is to go back to Iraq as big power intervention versus humanitarian intervention. There's a third case that sits in between. I think you are going to find people who argue that nuclear proliferation is the kind of reason that should justify military intervention. I think that is a highly problematical proposition. And beyond that, I think in all honesty, I think we need to get ready to live in a world of multiple nuclear powers for a long time to come, and probably more than none. And therefore, I do not think that I would give an open ticket to military intervention to prevent nuclear proliferation. And that's where the Iran question is going to come up immediately.
Well, I'm not sure that we'd probably end up disagreeing on particular cases, but I'm not sure I disagree on the logic. I mean, that there are circumstances in which there is behavior that is so barbaric that it becomes intolerable, and we have a compulsion to act, and Rwanda is the case where we should have acted, and, you know, I got no problem with that. What I would insist, though, is that even in those cases where we would intervene in response to genocide or ethnic cleansing or whatever the case happened to be, that we really ought to do so with our, the realist would say, do it with your eyes open and don't think you're going to go in and save the world, because you're not. And that's where I think it's only a case, it doesn't prove anything, but I think that the case of Somalia is is a useful one. I mean, my interpretation of post-Cold War U.S. foreign policy would be that that is the one case, maybe, that the United States genuinely acted in response to moral and ethical concerns. Maybe because I think the elder Bush wanted to leave on a grace note, and this looked like a way to do it. But there was a perception of this enormous excess U.S. military capacity. You know, at that moment, we can do anything. There was a perception that the problem of famine in Somalia would be one that could be relatively easily addressed, and indeed it was. You know, the intervention that happened when the elder Bush was still president was a successful operation. Clinton inherited that, and it was Clinton who had to decide, well, now that the starving people are being fed, what should we do? And the Clinton administration's response was, well, what we need to do is fix Somalia. We need to repair this failed state and install a legitimate and effective government so that then when we, the Americans and the international community, depart, that things wouldn't fall apart again. And that resulted in a war, because the effort to engineer a political solution in Somalia instigated the response of Muhammad Farah Aidid, and while the rest of us weren't paying attention, the Clinton administration starts to up the ante. And so you end up with a result that I think was morally problematic. So there are cases when action to put an end to barbarism is necessary, but don't kid yourself to think that you're going to fix everything.
There's an anecdote for this panel on this question. When the United States went into Somalia, there was over 90% public support. We had a UN resolution. We had, as Andy said, the best fighting force in the world. George Kennan woke up the morning that the decision was made and wrote himself an essay in his journal, in which he said in that essay, "This is a catastrophe. We have no understanding of what we're stepping into. We don't understand this society. it is going to lead absolutely to disaster. And then he said to himself, I will only cause the president problems if I publish this. So he put it away. They published it a year later in the New York Times after we had taken less than 50 casualties, but that was a reason to move out.
If I could just add one more thing, and because I appreciate that my own presentation could certainly be viewed as taking a very narrow view of things. But I'd also want to point out that the 90% of Americans who supported the Somalia humanitarian intervention did not urge their sons to go down to the local U.S. Army recruiting station and participate in this operation. It tends to be somebody else's kid who is sent to go do good. Now, if in sending somebody else's kid to go do good, good happened, then that might be nice. But what happened is Americans get killed. And quite frankly, I think that's a big thing that demands very careful attention on the part of anybody as they try to figure out those cases where the non-intervention rule deserves to be overridden. Who's going to foot the bill?
This lit up. Do you want a last question, Alan?
Well, I have a comments about Christian realism. John Summers raised the question of whether or not that term is really too narrow because we have many people in this country who are not Christian. I would actually raise the question of whether, or at least point out that as Niebuhr wrote about these issues, Christian realism may be too narrow a term, he was essentially talking about Protestant realism, that Catholics he didn't particularly like. Semi-Pelagian, I think, was the term he used, that they didn't have a sufficiently Augustinian, read through Calvin, understanding of sin. And so I wonder if Niebuhr's, got a problem there, or at least what we at a Catholic university ought to think about whether it's really Christian or whether it's one particular version. That's just a comment. I also, though, I hope we have time, because I really want your answer to a question I can't answer, and I'd love your guidance. And the question is, what is a realist position on the Israel-Palestine conflict? I mean, it just seems, I know this is a big topic, obviously, but it seems to me...
We hear all breakfast, or...
All right, each speaker will get 1 hour apiece, and we'll...
You all emphasized how the realist position is state-dependent and looks at balance of power between states. So what do you do when you have one party in the conflict that is a state and one party in the conflict that's a possible state? Do you say, well, a realist says we only deal with existing states, period. The Palestinians don't have one. That's too bad. Or do you say that a realist should want to do everything possible to give the Palestinians a state, because only through states and negotiations and conflict between states could any solution possibly be resolved.
You want to start?
I think part of what realism teaches you about the Palestinian-Israeli question is that it is hard to think about it from here, because the realists are very strong on the sense of limits. Everything is scarce in world politics. And what's really scarce in the Middle East, in the Israeli-Palestinian question, is security. Very scarce. So if you come from a country that's surrounded by the Atlantic, the Pacific, friendly neighbors north and south, you can make a lot of mistakes in your foreign policy and still recover, as we did in World War II. The situation you face from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean can be measured in the length of 128. And therefore, what happens, I think, in the situation is that everyone is obsessed by how narrow their choices are. And so for the Israeli, the argument is never again. There'll never be a time when there's no place to go for a Jew. And secondly, there is no second chance. You've got to get it right all the time on your security. For the Palestinian,
it seems to me, there is an equally powerful memory to the Israeli memory of never again. The Palestinian memory, I once read about it this way, the key to my father's house. The argument is Palestinians carry the key to their father's house that they never can go back to. And their narrow choices are precisely that they're not states. And until they get to the status of a state, they will never have the chance for fundamental security. So they don't have any choices about accepting half a loaf short of a state. Without a state, they're non-entities in world politics. They're human beings, they have dignity, but they're non-entities. And I remember talking to a major Palestinian diplomat one time, talking about Henry Kissinger, and he said, Henry Kissinger cannot imagine how to deal with anybody who's not a state. It just doesn't fit into his radar screen. And so for the Palestinian, the narrowness of their choice is, unless they get to be a state, they don't have standing, they don't have standing, they don't have security. So I think that's the simple argument for the two-state solution. The second argument, I think, is, and this again would go back to Andy's point, that, you know, who pays the price? My guess is that there's no way out of anything there that doesn't have the U.S. in it somehow. And maybe, I wouldn't necessarily advocate it, security guarantees. But that would be a very, very, very big step that we've never taken. But explicit security guarantees, part of a two-state solution, may put us into this narrow security unless we make a decision, a realist decision, for example, that it's not worth the price to pay, it's too unpredictable, and it exceeds by any standards what we ought to offer to do. So my sense is scarcity and security are at the heart of that problem.
I just want to second the motion. I think Brian has done a terrific job of summarizing the situation. Certainly, Alan, from the realist perspective, it would be much to be preferred if the Palestinians had a state, in part because the argument is that if you've got a state, there are ways you can be held accountable that you can't if you don't. And, of course, with that goes the recognition, de jure recognition by the UN. You can become a full-fledged member and so forth. But I just want to underscore what Brian said about the horrific constraints in that situation. I mean, anyone who's been there, and it's a small piece of territory. And people are, the issue of security is an ever-present, I mean, moment by moment is an issue. You know, when we were hit on 9/11, you know, people became very concerned about security, and that everyday citizens, could it happen here? What'll happen next? On and so forth. But then over time, those memories fade because you're not facing the same kind of sort of existential situation that they do every day in the Israel-Palestine part of the world. So you can kind of let it go, and it doesn't, every day doesn't sort of shadow you and haunt you. But it does there. So it's impossible for me to see any really good choices that people can make. You know, there may be less bad ones, but sort of good choices, I find it very difficult to see at this point. And well, let me add one other thing. A good bit, I think, of the direction that realism takes you, realism that accepts the issue of moral and ethical restraint, is that your task may be one, in many situations, of preventing the worst thing from happening rather than aiming for some optimal outcome. Aiming for that kind of optimal outcome may, in fact, invite the excesses that all of us have talked about. So it's often what's the worst thing that might happen and how to stop it.
I think my own view would be that realism would insist that we critically examine the proposition that U.S. and Israeli interests align. So much of the public discourse emphasizes this point, that we are strategic partners. I appreciate the extent that the first president who stands up and says, I'm not sure if our interests align, will be viewed as abandoning Israel. But nonetheless, at least from an analytical point of view, I think we need, it's long past time for us to recognize that our interests and Israeli interests diverge in very serious ways. We should not indulge in the notion that they are opposed by terrorists and we are involved in a war on terror, and therefore their enemies are our enemies, because that simply gets in the way, I think, of clear thinking. The truth of the matter, if I were an Israeli, I probably would support, by and large, Israeli national security policy, not because it's a wonderful policy, but because, as you were suggesting, the alternatives are almost non-existent. I'm not an Israeli. I'm an American. And I believe strongly that we have a very powerful national interest in getting the so-called grievances of the Palestinians off the table, that has become a rallying cry, an excuse for all kinds of behavior that is contrary to our own interests and, frankly, contrary to sort of the general interests of having a harmonious and orderly world. The only way to get it off the table is to get the Palestinians a state. The only way to get the Palestinians a state is not through a peace process. As a realist, I'm not believing in any peace there, but through partition, and partition that could have to be enforced by or guaranteed by a U.S. troop presence or some kind of security guarantees to both sides. I think that's what realism would suggest.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We've already run over. So, first of all, let me say that these three distinguished professors at our table have written an enormous amount of wonderful material, some of which is on sale outside, and a lot of it is also referenced on our website and their event page. And I encourage you to expand your understanding further of their own work. And finally, I hope you'll join me in thanking them for this terrific panel.
Right outside here. I'll check to make sure.
All right. Thanks a million.